Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Big blue skulls, purple shawls, big blue bulls, big blue bulls. Let's make little blue evil.
Welcome to Farce Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Ben.
I'm Pete.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where today we're talking about the second production episode of the second season, which aired 45 years ago today on December 7th, 1977. This was originally recorded between May 31st and June 2nd of 1977, and its special guest star, Zero Mostel, died shortly thereafter on September 8th, 1977. So they hadn't even come back for the second season yet when they found out the news. They would have been on break between the first half of production and the second half of production because he died in between the filming of the Bernadette Peters episode and their post-break Rudolph and Reyev episode. And the first episode with George Burns aired on September 16th. So they would have gotten the news before the season started. And yet they didn't rush into the New York airing of this episode. They didn't rush right in with a memoriam. They waited until what they thought was the right timing for it.
And the UK I'm looking at now waited even longer. The episode didn't air in the UK until March 5th. 1978.
So there wasn't any sort of apparent impetus to memorialize the man. That may have been because of, and then this is total speculation.
Yeah.
I have zero information about this.
Love it.
But in looking at his biography, there were a couple of notations about the fact that he didn't wish to be memorialized in any way. His body was cremated, and his resting place of his ashes is unknown.
Interesting. So
there is a chance that if they'd wanted to do something, when word trickled out, they decided that it would be disrespectful to respect him.
Here's a blessing of my broken brain.
Yeah.
I knew that piece already, that he died in between filming and airing. And I went, oh, I wonder what he died from. And then quickly forgot to look it up, even though I'm not supposed to look anything about him up.
I can tell you that he was working on a production in, I believe, Philadelphia. And he weighed about 300 pounds at the time and was trying to reduce his weight for the part. And was on what is described on Wikipedia as an ill-advised health risk diet, which created complications with his health. He went to the hospital to treat it after collapsing, either on stage or during rehearsal, and then received a bad diagnosis, and which led to his death soon thereafter.
We're talking an awful lot about him.
Yes.
Before getting into the quiz, and I'm certain you're talking about things that aren't in the quiz, but this episode's a weird one, and similar to the Steve Martin episode, it's hard to pull all the different runners out. So why don't we just go right into the quiz, do that, and then
we can talk freely about Zero Mostel.
Yes.
All right. Well then, Pete, let me give you the five questions that I've prepared for you about Zero Mostel, and we will find out what I think you should know about him. Question number one. The aforementioned biography of Zero Mostel by Jared Brown wanted to emphasize how miraculously his rise to fame was in the 1960s. It does this by, in the introduction, focusing on the circumstances he recovered from in the 1950s. What happened only a decade and a half before he made his winning of three Tony Awards between 1960 and 1965 such an astonishingly great piece of luck was that he had to recover from the following astonishing, terrible circumstances. A. Mostel's film and stage career had started in 1942, 3 years after his first wife, Clara, walked out on him for continuing to pursue arts and not getting a sensible job at the post office during the Works Progress Administration efforts. upon his success on arriving at the stage, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum in 1962, she reappeared and sued him for back support and for financial considerations. B. Called before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1955, Mostel had been named in prior testimony as a communist. On the advice of his agent and his second wife, he named names to save his career, but found himself persona non grata in Hollywood for almost a decade before he could get colleagues to forgive him again. Or C. On the way to rehearsal for The Grand Soup on Broadway in early 1960, Mostel was struck by a bus that fully ran over his leg. He was rushed to the NIC, where they said, "Let's amputate." And he said, "No," and was transferred to a different hospital, where it took almost half a year and multiple operations in order to eventually get it to a part where they didn't have to actually amputate, and it took him even longer to recover. One of those three is true.
B.
No, it's the Nick.
Oh, wow.
He was called before HUAC in 1955, but he pled the fifth.
Okay.
And was blacklisted for many years afterwards. So that actually was the other circumstance that his career needed to recover from, but it wasn't because he named, it was because of the exact opposite. Question number two. Mostel's first film role was in Du Barry Was a Lady, a 1943 musical starring Lucille Ball and Gene Kelly that has come up on the podcast twice before. Mostel sang one of the signature tunes in the film that happens to have been featured on The Muppet Show. Which was it? A. Friendship, which was performed by Ethel Merman and Scooter in an episode. B. You Are My Sunshine, which was performed by a happy Kuzbanian in Hugga Wugga in an episode. Or C. Trick question. Mostel performs the comic song Madam, I Like Your Crepe Suzettes by Burton and Lane, which has not entered the canon of standards.
I'm gonna go with C.
Yeah, that's the trap. he performed Friendship amongst many other people in the cast.
I was torn between A and C.
Madam, I Like Your Crepe Suzettes was performed by Red Skelton and Martha Mears, who dubbed for Lucille Ball. Question number three. Prior to appearing on The Muppet Show, Mostel had worked with the Children's Television Workshop, but interestingly, he only worked in one of their three focused shows that had premiered prior to his death. Which was it? A. On the third and fourth seasons of Sesame Street from 1971 to 1972, Mostel appeared as a stage magician, The Great Zilch, where he and the Count Von Count demonstrated counting down to zero. B. On The Electric Company, Mostel was the voice of the Spellbinder, a vaguely Indian fakir character who would substitute letters in words and change their meanings until jock superhero Letterman changed the spelling of that. Or C. On 321 Contact in 1976, Mostel and Gene Wilder co-hosted an episode about the science of human communication, modeling good and bad communication, and talking about how facial expressions help with understanding.
I feel like I'm going to fall into a trap again. C.
That is untrue. Only Gene Wilder appeared in the human communication episode, which did not happen until 1980. The Electric Company is true.
It's three for three that I've been between the right one and the wrong one, and I've gone with the wrong one.
Wilder plays the voice of the Letterman, and Joan Rivers provides the voiceover narration of each of the segments. Question number four. Mostel is remembered as a film and stage actor, but it could be said that he's most famous for his roles that are just ports of his stage successes put on film. For example, in 1961, he played John in Ionesco's The Rhinoceros. He won the Tony for Best Actor and then reprised this in film with Gene Wilder in 1974. What of the next three of the examples of this is true about his career? A. In 1962, he played Pseudolus in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, where he won the Tony for Best Lead of a Musical, and it was remade into a film with him in 1966. B. In 1964, he played Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof, which was remade in 1971 of the film role for which he was nominated but did not win Best Actor. Or C. In 1973, he played Max Bialystock in The Producers, which was made into a film in 1976. He was not nominated, but Gene Wilder was nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
C.
Incorrect. The Producers was not based on a play at all.
Oh, okay.
But was a film in 1976 then made into a musical in 2001, which was then made back into a film.
Yep.
He did originate the role of Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof.
But he was not in the movie.
Correct.
That's the only thing I know about him.
Topol was nominated for Best Actor because of that role in 1971. He did play Pseudolus in Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum and then reprised that role on film.
Got me on a technicality.
Which brings us to number five, The Henson Connection, where I give Pete 60 seconds in which to try and connect Zero Mostel's top four on IMDb to a film featuring Jim Henson. Zero Mostel's top four are The Producers, with Gene Wilder, Kenneth Mars, and Renee Taylor. The Front, with Woody Allen, Michael Murphy, and Danny Aiello. Watership Down, with John Hurt, Denham Elliott, Nigel Hawthorne, and Ralph Richardson. And A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, with Phil Silvers, Buster Keaton, Michael Crawford, amongst others. Using any of the members of those casts, you have 60 seconds to try and get Zero Mostel to Jim Henson, starting now.
Uh-oh, I thought I had this locked, and then now I'm doubting myself.
Okay, talk it through.
Is or is not, I don't think he is now that I think about it, Mel Brooks in A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum?
No, he's not.
He's not, okay. So that's why I had my fingers crossed that whole time, and then as you were saying names, I was like, oh no, I don't think he is. So I have to go through Gene Wilder. Is Gene Wilder in one of the Muppet movies? Feels like he should be. Oh boy. Okay, what else can I do?
20 seconds.
Gene Wilder is... Oh! Gene Wilder to, now I'm blanking on his name.
10 seconds.
The comic. The Silver Streak to Muppets Take Manhattan. He's in it. Oh no, I'm gonna lose this on a stupid technicality, even though I did it. I want you to know, listeners, I did this one. I just didn't do it.
Lots to unpack here. The Producers, a Mel Brooks film.
Yeah, okay, I also realize that now, too.
Has Mel Brooks in an uncredited voice part in Springtime for Hitler. And I went back and forth on whether or not I'd give that to you, but I figured if you got it, you got it.
Richard Pryor.
Richard Pryor is in the Muppet movie,
where
he sells Gonzo a set of balloons, if I'm not mistaken.
I got the wrong movie.
Gene Wilder, I believe, is in the Muppet movie. So if you could have closed there. Kenneth Mars in The Producers is in What's Up, Doc? And it took me more than a minute to remember the name of Austin Pendleton, who he's with in What's Up, Doc, who's in the Muppet movie. So I would have had the exact same problem you did running out of time trying to remember the name of Austin Pendleton if I'd been on trial. There are lots of other fun connections. Michael Murphy, who's in The Front, is in MASH with Elliot Gould, who's in the Muppet movie. Milton Berle, who's in Mad World with Phil Silvers, is in the Muppet movie. So we could have gone through Forum that way. And Denham Elliott is Indy's best friend in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, who gets lost in his own museum.
Well, similar to Muppets canon,
yeah,
I only like and remember Temple of Doom.
Okay. So you would have forgotten, therefore, that because he's in Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, you could then connect him to...
Harrison Ford.
Yeah, which is, therefore, to Frank Oz. Yeah. Whereas I connected him to Sean Connery, who's with John Cleese in Time Bandits, who's in Great Muppet Caper. Also in Time Bandits is Ralph Richardson, who's also in Watership Down. So there were bazillions of connections here. I think you did very well in almost landing Richard Pryor.
Except the wrong movie.
Oops. So, Zero Mostel's biography is really interesting reading, particularly because his biographer spends large portions of every page saying, so Mostel said this, there's no evidence of this. He also changed his story in lots of interviews over the course of his life, so we're not quite sure about any of this. He was a dedicated storyteller and just enjoyed having people think that whatever he was talking about was entertaining, and just therefore made stuff up. It's therefore an incredible biography to read, because you have to take every single, quote, fact, unquote, with a grain of salt.
Mm-hmm.
And on his IMDb page, there's a quote about him working with the Muppets, where he says, working with the Muppets is great, because if you don't like their line readings, at least you can use them to clean the glass. Or something. I don't think he actually probably disliked working with the Muppets, but insulting them was funnier than saying he had a good time. And I think that sums up his general relationship with trying to talk about him and his career is, who knows? Because he was much more interested in getting you to laugh than to get an accurate picture of his own life.
Well, I'm going to jump way ahead,
mm-hmm.
because this ties into what you're talking about. At the end of the episode, in the closing spot, Kermit thanks Zero by saying this man has joined the ranks of the Muppet Monsters. He comes out with the two monsters making a face and monster noises. And then when Kermit says, we'll see you next time on the Muppet Show, Zero leans forward and says, must there be a next time?
Right, bringing in negative energy out of basically nowhere, but in order to get the good joke.
Yeah, and knowing the fact that he did die in between the filming and airing of this,
it
brought a little bit of a morbid laugh from me to be like, no, there won't be a next time, Zero.
Not for him. Anyway.
Yeah, that now provides context for that joke. That, yeah, he just, he wanted the laugh. He didn't care about who he may or may not have hurt.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Very, very interesting man. And I feel like the introduction to his biography that I read, I barely scraped the surface of who he is. And considering that it's probably lies, half-truths, and anecdotes, I barely scraped the surface of what people say about him, mm-hmm. as opposed to who he actually is.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, let's talk about his intersection with the episode and the rest of the episode, which also may or may not be successful in its offensivity. And let's begin with Scooter not in the dressing room, but outside the dressing room. This is the second time this has happened in broadcast order, but the first time in production order, because that's also how the episode with Rich Little started.
Scooter says 25 seconds to Curtin. He's looking for Zero. Fozzie tells Scooter that he's in the dressing room eating. And then we cut to Zero and he shouts, I'm not eating, I'm being eaten! With his arm in Behemoth Monster's mouth.
He then, apparently to either season himself or try and distract the Behemoth Monster by having him eat other things, just pours random objects into the mouth until it cuts to the curtain.
Including water. Ben?
Yeah.
It cut to the curtain at exactly 25 seconds.
Congratulations, production episode 2.
You started off on the right foot. I don't remember what...
or arm.
Nice. I don't remember what episode 1 was, but... you nailed it on episode 2. I'm curious as to whether or not they were, because it was separate cuts, it was easier to time it out properly.
But also because it was, he could just do stuff mm-hmm. until they decided they needed to cut. Like, maybe he had four more things on his dressing table that he put into the mouth of the behemoth, but they cut at when it made it accurate.
Yeah.
They'd done 18 seconds, he would have had two fewer things going.
Waldorf then shouts, oh, please let them be funny this once.
I like that they're basically positioned in prayer. Like, they're both looking up at the sky, or the roof of the box.
And then Gonzo shoots a flare slash sparks out of the trumpet.
I labeled it Roman candle. It has a very definite firework of extended firework effect.
Yeah, but it's not a Roman candle because things don't then shoot out of it. Like, the sparks go out of it, mm-hmm. but Roman candles, projectiles eject.
As opposed to just a jet of sparks and fire.
Yeah, so that's why I wrote flare. It reminded me of
flare,
like, a
is
road
probably
flare.
Best, yeah.
Kermit says, in an attempt to placate the culture lovers of our audience, they are opening the show with a little classical music.
And in the middle of that sentence, that literally cuts to Sam in the wings, standing there right next to the lights, saying, at last, at last.
And then, after introducing the song Polonaise in A-flat, Fozzie comes from behind the curtain, whispers that the concert pianist couldn't make it, so Fozzie wrote a new intro and hands it to him.
Yeah, so Kermit has said Chopin's Polonaise in A-flat, and then the, quote, whole new intro that Fozzie has written is that exact sentence with the addition of, as performed by Dr. Teeth. I expected at least some punch-up here from Fozzie.
I liked the fact that it was literally the same thing, except basically he crossed out whatever the concert pianist's name was supposed to be. It seems like it should be on the exact same card, just with a strike through and Fozzie's handwriting on it.
Which point it cuts back to Sam, just shocked and appalled at this new information. We then get the Polonaise in A-flat by Chopin, which has wild enthusiasm from Dr. Teeth, a zoot solo, and then a Janis solo, zoot spinning around in a circle, and Animal shouting Chopin periodically.
This might be my favorite Dr. Teeth thing yet. It's got interesting camera work, and I like the cover of... I've never heard Chopin sound like this before, which I think is why I liked it, because it wasn't just a jazz standard or something in their wheelhouse. I was like, oh, I vaguely recognize this song, and also, it sounds good.
There's a future episode where, in order to have some culture in the show, Sam approvingly has them play a minuet. Mm-hmm. And I think that particular sketch is funnier in my memory than this, in terms of Dr. Teeth and the Mayhem being frustrated at how restrained they are, that they're playing something that will meet Sam's expectations. Mm. So this is
just a cover.
Exactly.
Yeah. And they're into it.
They're having a grand old time.
Yeah.
But therefore it wasn't as overtly comic, except for the fact that it is, as you say, a hard rock cover of classical music.
Yeah.
I also was distracted by the fact that the Polonaise in A-flat, or this particular movement of the Polonaise in A-flat, was used by Monty Python when John Cleese does a light opera on the life of Oliver Cromwell to this music. He originally wrote it in 1967 for the radio show. I'm sorry, I'll read that again, but it wasn't released officially by Python until 1989.
Huh.
So it couldn't have been a particular influence. I think it's just one of those things that people associate with very good classical music. Mm-hmm. For example, it's played by Jeffrey Rush's character in Shine.
Okay.
Early on in his youth and career. So it's one of those pieces that, to interpret it in solo piano very well, Wikipedia assures me, requires a certain degree of mastery.
I was going to make a joke about, you didn't mean Jeffrey Rush, you meant blank, but I honestly could not remember the name of the person who I wrote the trivia questions for.
That you were...
That I just assumed was Jeffrey Rush. Ben, I brain is broken.
I'm really sorry, Pete. I'm just glad that we're going to have these episodes for you to listen back to when you no longer know who you are.
Hey, I'll be very entertained with myself.
Who's this guy? He's great.
He's very funny. He should be a semi-professional comedian.
As they're done with the music and about to go backstage, we have one last shot of Sam in the wings, whereas he dabs at his face with a giant red handkerchief, which I think is the opposite of what Sam should be using.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I suppose it is a very red-blooded American way to have a handkerchief, but I sort of picture him as a lace-edged white handkerchief monogrammed kind
of guy. We then go into the box to check with Statler and Waldorf, and Waldorf says, you know, I'm really going to enjoy tonight.
Statler asks, wait, you plan on enjoying the show?
And Waldorf says, no, I plan to watch television, and then pulls out a television.
This surprised the heck out of me, and I laughed very much at the at the sudden manipulation and appearance of the TV, like... There are three very good Muppets holding and carrying things in this episode. So they must have worked out a pretty good mechanism that they reused multiple times. Mm. And this is the first of the three, but I was still impressed with how well Waldorf was able to pick up that television. Considering that he's not a Swedish Chef or Fozzie kind of Muppet where that you can use fingers.
Yeah, he's not a real hand Muppet.
Yeah, and they got that miniaturized television.
But still giant.
Into the box, yeah.
We then cut to our backstage runner. Or the introduction of our backstage segment.
We have some business with Kermit talking about Chopin, but then as the mayhem come off stage, they remind him to not forget that today is payday, which leads into Kermit discovering that there's not any money in the money tin, and Scooter then comes out and asks what the problem is. And receives a coincidental phone call from his uncle who owns the theater saying, we can get you the money that you need, Kermit, but first you have to do an act for us. I don't understand why they decided to have J.P. Gross call at this exact moment instead of having Scooter call him. The one obvious answer is the dumb joke of Gross's cigar smoke coming out of the receiver of the telephone.
But you could do that if you called him, too.
Yep.
I didn't write down exactly how this transition happened. I don't remember if there was a line about a reason for him calling.
Well, what happens is that after they've established how much money they need to pay the cast of The Muppet Show...
Oh, how much do you need, Kermit?
Oh, Scooter, $27.14.
In 1977 dollars... Pete, would you like to know how much buying power that is today?
I would very much like to know.
$133.47.
Wow, that's high finance.
Still a bargain at twice the price.
So how many Muppet Show cast members do we think we have? We've got the five members of the Mayhem.
Yeah.
We've got Fozzie and Piggy.
Mm-hmm.
Gonzo doesn't show up. Scooter does an introduction. And we know that he's getting paid regardless. We assume Kermit needs to get paid.
Mm-hmm.
That's nine by my count so far.
Jumping ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've also got the female Muppet in the first segment, the dog.
So that's two more to 11. Then we've got Bunsen and Beaker.
Yep.
That's we have 13.
Sam. We have all the dancers.
Yeah. Let's assume they're not getting paid quite as much.
Yeah, they're probably working on a day rate.
Not being super specific on the dancers means we're probably rounding out to 20. That's 15 without the dancers and Rolf.
And Granny wasn't planned for, right. So
I'd say 20 is pretty good, which means that that's about $7 a piece.
At $27?
At current rates.
Oh, I gotcha. I was thinking they're basically, let's round up to 27. They're all making a dollar a show. Still not a lot.
No.
Maybe The Muppet Show is running mostly on exposure.
I wouldn't at all be surprised. But, yes, after having established how much they need to pay the whole cast in this ludicrous amount.
I think he does say cast and crew. So that's even more.
Lighting and all the guys that have to bring all the lights down from a mile in the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
That takes time and effort, probably even overtime.
Yeah.
Then the phone rings. Scooter goes over to answer it. And upon answering it, Kermit tells us That's J.P. Gross, the bloodless old tightwad who owns the theater, in some of the worst exposition we've encountered on the show so far.
Mm-hmm.
Would this be a good time to point out that this was the tryout script by Joseph Bailey?
Sure.
So according to the Muppet Wikia, they refer back to Memoirs of a Muppet Writer. And on pages 12 and 13, Bailey spells out that this was the spec script that he wrote for The Muppet Show, that they didn't have enough money, and they went to Gross, and Gross said, yeah, I can give you the money if you put on what I think is good entertainment. And that turns out to be Lady Wrestlers. And I feel like some of the creakiness of this episode that we're pointing out right here feels like, despite the fact that this was an audition piece that he then reworked and resubmitted, and they had time to rewrite this, and yet they still have left in some of the what feels like very spec script, I don't work for the Muppet Show yet architecture awkwardness in this.
I feel like this is the worst it gets.
Fair.
I think it gets better from here.
But yeah, they're doing a lot of
business for not a lot of money.
A lot of awkward shuffling of shoe leather.
So yes, J.P. Gross says, I'll cover it if you do an act that I would like. And Kermit tries guessing at it. He guesses an Irish tenor, a dog act, jugglers, spoon players? What? Answer is Lady Wrestlers.
And Kermit says, yeah, well, that's terrific. I was afraid he would want something tasteless. Then we have him go to the curtain where he says, it's time for our special guest to do something special. The list of other acts that it could be, this phrase, there are lots of moments where I actually do feel like the script has clever wordplay in it.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk later about a Zero Mostel segment, which is scripted entirely by Jerry Jewell. So I don't think we can say ever how much of this is Bailey, how much of this is the whole writing staff. Obviously, there's going to be a push and pull in that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I agree. I wanted to say that to underscore your point of that bit is awkward, but it's definitely not, that awkwardness does not thread throughout the rest of the episode.
Yeah, and it's awkward, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
Right.
Because it's still fun and entertaining. It's not like we're saying, oh, this segment is like, no, it has good jokes. It's entertaining. As you alluded to, the smoke bit, very fun. It's just, like I said, it's a lot of business.
But switching gears into the idea of things that may not quite work, We have Zero Mostel and the Queen Muppet from the Twiggy episode performing What Do Simple Folk Do by Lerner and Lowe from Camelot in 1960. And I would say that Camelot and Oklahoma are my go-to reasons why people should hate musicals.
I'm nodding so hard right now. I like musicals, and I've had experiences with Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
I've never seen it. I never need to see it. This is my only experience with Camelot, and now I know I never need to see it.
It's, in my opinion, the opposite of entertaining,
yeah.
The opposite of funny, and the opposite of successful.
The show or this segment?
The show.
Okay.
But therefore, that carries over in large part to this segment.
Mm-hmm.
They are working, in my opinion, very hard to provide this song with extra bits that they can do in order to make it successful.
And those bits are good.
But the lyrics of this supposedly clever song, which has three acts, where Mostel, dressed effectively as King Henry VIII, says, what do simple folk do all day? And upon being told by the queen that they sing, he then assumes that the kind of singing that they would do is high-class operatic kingly singing. And there's supposed to be some ironic merit to that. Similarly, when he asks again, okay, yeah, but really, what do? And she says, they dance. He then does a courtly dance. The tension here is supposed to be, oh, but of course, the simple folk wouldn't do that kind of dancing, you dumb king. If this is in the original source material, that's the worst comic tension I've ever... Oh, wow. Royalty might not be in touch with the common people.
Yeah.
Yeah, no good. Pulp and William Shatner did better versions of this, and I hate that song, too.
I wasn't sure if it was my prejudice against period pieces that made me just automatically go, ugh, I hate this.
No, I think the jokes in the lyrics aren't clever enough to carry this.
They sing?
I surmise.
The only thing that's good is that Mostel is making a meal out of him doing the dramatic irony of, I'm going to sing opera, I'm going to dance. But the final verse, the whole thing is what do elevated people do? Well, they ask what the common people do. Oh, a comic reversal. No, no good, very bad.
Yeah. There is, however, real dog.
That's right.
And puppet dog.
With a pretty good substitution. Amusingly enough, there is something amusing in this sketch. Wow, I can't believe I just said that. Zero Mostel jumps over the real dog and before it's substituted for a puppet. So the thing that could have hurt an animal, they don't have the puppet for. Especially in rewatching this and knowing that he'd had a leg busted so badly that he almost needed to have it amputated, I was even more concerned for that dog.
Well, it was 16 years earlier, 17 years earlier. I will say there were 4 human Muppet kisses in this because the dog licks him, he licks the dog back, and then he goes to kiss the queen's hand, and then the dog licks him again. So, 4 human Muppet kisses. The other thing about this sketch is, speaking of auditions, this was another female audition. This was not Lou.
Oh, okay.
This was a different performer named Rashenda Carey, who did the voice of the Queen, but not the puppeteering of the Queen.
Huh.
I believe that was Jim Henson.
That would make sense. It is Jim Henson doing the Queen in both the Twiggy episode and the Tales of Tinker Dee, where for which the puppet was designed.
But there was no woman on the cast at this point, so they needed someone, so they got her to sing, but she is not credited with any other work in this episode.
So, congratulations once again, Muppets. You are profiting on the labor of anonymous people who weren't even really hired for their work that you broadcast.
Hey, we did just establish that The Muppet Show pays more in exposure than... Except this isn't even exposure because she's not in the credits.
That's right.
So you're welcome for your exposure on this podcast, Rashenda Carey. I'm still sorry.
Yeah, I'm still sorry. After that fabulous bit from Camelot, we have Statler and Waldorf doing what I wished I could have done, which is not pay attention to that segment.
Yeah, they're watching TV. Waldorf wants to know what the name of the movie is that they're watching.
They say it's an awful film, a terrible film, but upon reaching the possibility of maybe we could watch The Muppet Show instead, they shake their heads violently.
And then say, wonderful, terrific film. This segment goes against my assertion from last week of they only say good things about guest segments unless they're the foils. So that was a long-standing, less-than-one-week theory.
To be fair, they aren't specifically saying that the segment they just didn't watch was bad. They are saying we could go back to watching The Muppet Show. So they're criticizing the show at large as being not as good as whatever's on television.
Yeah.
But its placement still implies...
That couldn't get them away from the television.
Yep.
My caveat was that this is a runner of its own, so it's not necessarily like they're, as you were just saying, commenting on that. So I think it still kind of holds. It's just very funny that last week I said it.
Yep.
Already gone. We then go backstage again. Kermit's on the phone trying to find lady wrestlers at this late a stage in the show.
Animal is passing by when there's a knock on the door, and Kermit asks Animal to get the door. Animal, upon getting the request shouted at him a couple of times, rushes off stage and comes back holding the door. Muppet holding a physical object number 2, because he then drops it on the floor and comes up with his arms free and walks off stage. So there's some... something going on in terms of him being able to hold the door and dislodge it all in one unbroken shot.
Wild speculation.
Yeah.
there's another performer literally holding the bottom of the door.
Mm, and just slides out from his arms.
Yeah, and then when he releases, they just lower it.
Yeah, it's an interesting...
Same with the TV, probably. Someone else was just
pushing the TV up and the hand was next to it.
Yep.
It's worth watching and looking at, viewers, listeners, whatever you are, audience, because it's good. Mm-hmm. And obviously one of the great things about the Muppets is how they're able to come up with good technical solutions to staging problems in order to help the Muppets feel real. I was impressed with this particular action, which is why I'm bringing it up. It's worth, if you're going to watch this afterwards or watch it again, just keeping that in the back of your mind to go, wait, how did they do that?
Well, after getting the door, an older lady enters.
Tall, very big yes. woman comes in to confront Kermit. She says about Animal that he's a very, what was the word, impressive doorman?
Yeah, I believe so. I didn't write it down, but that sounds right to me.
And then the script
just kind of ends.
Yeah.
Just goes away. Just fades.
My, what a dynamic doorman you have here.
The action of establishing this character is also clunky. Mm-hmm. It's the other piece where there's pacing issues in terms of she will come back two backstages from now. There's some chew leather about thanks for waiting, sorry to make you wait, that sort of stuff. But it is weird that she was just hanging about backstage for a couple of almost 10 minutes.
Yeah, Kermit was there. What did he then do to right. then say, sorry to make you wait, that we didn't see?
Because...
Did he just walk away from her with mm-hmm. no other word spoken?
He doesn't apparently come in front of the curtain in between any other segments, but the next time we see him talking with Sam, she's nowhere to be seen and he's doing other busy work.
Mm-hmm.
In the prop room, instead of backstage getting things ready. It's a little weird. But before we get to the prop room, we have At the Dance.
Yes, which is a series of tennis jokes.
The only thing I found particularly interesting about this is there's one pair of puppets that's very funny in that they actually have a pair of tennis balls, make mm-hmm. a bad tennis court pun, and the tennis balls are not our modern Wilson yellow. They're the traditional English white,
mm-hmm.
which I thought was a nice artifact of a day gone by 45 years ago. But also, there are a couple of pairs of Whatnot Muppets here that were in the last future At the Dance that we covered last episode.
Oh, okay.
And yet they're being done by different puppeteers.
Oh.
The second set of Muppet dancers, the female character is the one asking, how's your backhand and how's your forehand?
Do you play tennis?
Of course.
How's your backhand?
Fair.
How's your forehand?
Oh, they're terrific.
That was the character that Frank voiced in the previous At the Dance that we talked about in terms of broadcast order.
Okay.
But in this segment, Frank is playing the head of the woman that was transformed, the small girl that was transformed by the Svengali, but with a new body, asking about...
You say you watched 6 tennis matches today? How do you feel?
Fine. Just fine.
And so they didn't feel any particular ownership of any of these At the Dance Muppets. Again, throwing it to you, saying that if they were playing characters that we cared about and recognized and had names, they'd probably be consistent. But instead, they're just doing whatever joke they're assigned or they think is funny or they think they can deliver the line best.
Yeah. Do you know how I knew that those two Muppets were played by Frank Oz?
No. How did you know?
Because they were pogoing. Besides the voice. The voice gives it away.
Voice definitely gives it away. I'm glad you got some pogoing because I didn't notice.
Yeah. She pogos. And I was pleased to see pogoing, but very upset that that wasn't Pogo George.
Glad I could set you up for that.
Yeah. I was going to make a comment on it and you...
I lobbed that one
yep,
to you.
And I slammed it down. Speaking of tennis, one last time, at the very last joke of the segment is someone makes a big racket joke, and then Crazy Harry enters and asks if they wanted a big racket, and then explodes something.
There is a fade to black, which traditionally means that when we come back, we would have the UK spot. Pete, is this prop room sketch that I've now alluded to twice the UK spot?
Hey, Ben. Yes, it is.
So,
it's, I believe, the second
joke that is just exposition as part of the runner is the thing that was cut.
Uh-huh.
Well, let's see. We got Fozzie is doing a pantomime with Zero Mostel. Got a musical number with
Musical number, good, good.
With Zoot and Ralph. And then, of course, we got the lady, the lady wrestlers.
That's absurd.
So I believe it's the second time in the history of The Muppet Show that we've had a non-song UK spot as well. But the first time that it's been plot-driven.
Well,
oh no,
because the Steve Martin one was the other one. I mean, that turned into a performance at the end of it. But it was a lengthy bit of related to the runner of auditioning for the show with Gonzo and Yolanda.
Yeah, that would make this the third.
Oh, okay. Because which other one are you thinking of?
In season one, there was the Rolf Sherlock Holmes sketch.
Right. Yep.
Ben, I remembered something that you didn't.
Yeah.
And I didn't look anything up.
Congratulations. I do refer to that UK spot a lot whenever we're talking about abnormal UK spots.
Mm-hmm.
So congratulations.
I retained something. But yeah, as you alluded to, it's just Sam and Kermit. And Sam wants Kermit to run down the show to make sure that things are morally upright, cultural, and wholesome.
I thought that the timing on this was very odd, and that helps me understand why. In my opinion, the fact that a good quarter of this sketch is just Kermit saying lady wrestlers again and again
just
and trying to say it inaudibly so that he doesn't have to admit it to Sam, I thought it was very funny, but at the same time, I was confused with how much real estate it was getting in the sketch.
Mm-hmm.
And now that I know that they were effectively doing 2 minutes to be cut, it makes so much more sense.
They also, in the sketch, when Kermit's running down the things that are to come, he talks about a pantomime that Fozzie is going to do with Zero Mostel.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not aired, but there are behind-the-scenes pictures from that segment. So they did film or do something with that, and then that also has not seen the light of day or didn't make the edit.
Bizarre.
Finally, after Sam is outraged, he claims that one day he'll get his just desserts. Beautiful Day Monster walks by with a pie and hits Sam in the face with the pie for our first hit of the episode.
Fair enough. We then cut to Muppet Labs, where this is the first production introduction of Beaker. And we talked when we did the first broadcast appearance of Beaker, where Bunsen says, and now this is my assistant Beaker. And you said, I wonder what it's going to be like to see the actual introduction. Will I be mad that these have been done out of order? Well, here we are, Pete. Does this feel like, continuity-wise, it should have happened after, in terms of broadcast order?
Yeah, because Beaker just kind of shakily sneaks, but doesn't want to be there.
But he's not introduced in of, this is my assistant Beaker, and this is his role as product tester.
Yep.
He just says, Beaker can get over here.
Yep.
Like so, he's in Mortal Kombat.
I guess it does make sense.
I will say that Beaker felt different physically, though. He didn't quite seem the same in terms of his structural integrity of his head.
Mm.
The tube was a little floppier, a little less straight, and his demeanor, we talked a little bit about the fact that he hasn't started going meep yet, and he's mostly silent, but he, unless he's screaming, here he's still teetering in the edge in terms of how he's vocalizing.
He's almost silent in that sense.
It does feel prototypical in this appearance, in that he's not quite fully formed.
Bunsen is extolling the virtues of magnetic carrots.
You can carry these new magnetic carrots home on the roof of your car and store them on the ceiling of your refrigerator.
And then, as he's describing them, a metal rabbit hops into frame and
Bunsen admits that the only problem is that they attract metal rabbits. This is why I paused when you said the first hit of the episode, because I was thinking about this one. The rabbit slaps the hell out of Beaker to get him out of the way and be able to get to the magnetic carrots.
So that's hit two.
After the close of this sketch, Statler and Waldorf are still watching TV in the box. And upon the suggestion that maybe they switch the channels to something else, Statler then is confused by what else is on the television. Waldorf says, it looks like two old guys sitting in a box watching TV.
Statler says, that's crazy. No one would watch junk like that. Good joke.
Love Meta.
Well, you should give Mark Zuckerberg some money then.
Damn it. I'm not able to say that anymore. Ugh, you've ruined me, Mark. Just like you've ruined democracy. We then have a Zero Mostel segment where Sam lets himself into the dressing room and introduces himself as the person who upholds the dignity and decency on the show, and then proceeds to hold forth about how the show is absolutely lacking in culture and that it must be cleansed of silliness. And as he goes on and on and on about everything that's morally bankrupt about the show, Mostel makes faces behind him and generally leans into the total lack of dignity that Sam is saying is every place else in the show. But every time Sam turns back and is talking directly to Zero instead of expostulating, Zero abandons whatever he's doing, and whether it's to be about to hit him with a hammer or making wild eyes and using his makeup pancakes as a weird tongue, he then looks attentive and pleasant until
and Sam agrees with him, usually repeats the last word he said.
Yeah.
Going back to what you said about the runner, there's a weird inconsistency within this too, because the game escalates so quickly and then de-escalates so quickly, because as you said, he does the thing with the makeup pancake, then he pulls out a hammer and then throws that behind him, then he pulls out a gun, puts it to the back of Sam's head as if he's going to shoot him in the back of the head execution style. Mm-hmm. And then as Sam turns around, he then puts the gun in his own mouth.
As if that's the acceptable thing to do in terms of, yeah, this is all fine. I'm not doing anything you would be offended by. I'm just gonna shoot myself in the face.
Yeah. It's so dark, and I loved it.
Pete, are there any Disney warnings about this episode?
None.
Oh my goodness.
There was not a title card at the beginning. There's not even, like, the rated PG, mm-hmm. like, some, when there's tobacco use that right. says features tobacco. Nope.
Putting a gun in your own mouth instead of shooting a bird that's in front of you, no problems at all.
No. But then, so that's the third thing they do.
Yeah.
And then after that one, yeah, Zero just de-escalates into making faces and mocking. Like,
oh, by the way, in the transcript, the key photo from this sketch is Zero with the gun in his mouth. So if you're interested in whether or not this is a thing that is okay, there's a very graphic depiction of it on the Muppet Wikia.
It's also in the episode guide. It's one of the two pictures. It's Zero with the makeup thing in his mm-hmm. mouth, and then it's the gun in his mouth.
Wow. Deeply creepy.
Very funny. However, because of that weird de-escalation where then it just devolves into the funny faces, mm-hmm. it then comes crashing to a halt for me where I was like, oh, this is real fun. I'm like, oh, this is what it's doing now?
The button is that when he leaves, Zero starts repeating the word dignity and does it in an increasingly manic and bestial way, eventually squawking and flapping, removing any concept that he might be a dignified person. I, in general, had mixed feelings about this sketch in that I think he's doing a lot of stuff and it happens so quickly that when it doesn't land, I wasn't really bothered by it.
Mm-hmm.
But it also didn't make me laugh.
Yeah.
I think he's being true to the concept of the execution of the sketch. That mm-hmm.
Execution?
that Mostel, as a professional actor and performer, gives his all into whatever he's doing for the split second while Sam isn't looking at him. It doesn't matter if it is additive or cumulative, he's just doing it, and then he moves on to the next thing.
I also think that as a contrast to the first segment, where he's being very dignified, yeah, this is interesting as well. We then continue our backstage runner, because this is where, as you talked about earlier, Granny and Kermit finally start talking.
This is where she reveals,
yes,
that she is Granny the Gouger,
a lady wrestler, as J.P. Grouse would say.
And she'd like to audition for being on the show tonight. Kermit thinks that this might be a joke, and she takes offense, saying, is it because I'm old? You know, you're going to be old soon. You should treat me with respect. And then she
winds up
and slams the radio PA intercom system that's on the wall, knocking it crazily towards the audience, and then stalks off.
So does this count as a hit? Because she was trying to hit Kermit.
I don't think that's true.
He dodges. He gets out of the way.
Yeah. But he gets out of the way, and then she's like, she winds up, he drops, she hits in his absence.
Yes.
Now, obviously, I'm no good at kayfabe. So, to me, I'm just like, yeah, she had plenty of time to, if she wanted to, switch to hitting him. So I think she's making a point by hitting the radio specifically in order to let him know that could have been you.
Yeah, see, I take it as he just dodged too early, but she was trying to hit him.
Mm.
But either way, as we've talked about before in What's a Hit, What's Not a Hit, she intended to hit.
Yep.
And she
successfully came in contact.
Yeah. So even though it is an inanimate object, she hits it.
I agree.
So it is our third hit. And then continues to threaten Kermit as the sketch ends.
And when that day comes, you're going to be sorry you weren't nicer to Granny.
I think I'm sorry already.
But it is also, in terms of rising action and escalation, it's a little weird. We talked about the weirdness of him then saying, okay, well, why are you here? Let's get back into the flow of this runner. But it also ends inconclusively.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just cut to the next number with no transition whatsoever, except for the fact that it is one of the things that in the UK spot Kermit listed as was going to be done on the show. He says, we have a number with Zoot and with Rolf, and now we have a number with Zoot and with Rolf that Sam approved, where they do an instrumental non-vocal version of Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, which is a song I most associate with Steven Spielberg's terrible sense of humor in the 1989 film Always, where it's a song that smoke jumpers dance to.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm just saying, it's very good and very romantic in the film, but I think Spielberg picked it because of the smoke pun, and yeah, this is the man who made 1941.
Hey, Steven Spielberg has not written the most successful joke of all time. That goes right to his buddy George.
Good point. We can't expect miracles. The premise of the sketch is that as they are performing Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, once it's recognizable, once they get to the chorus of the instrumental, then smoke starts pouring out of the bell of Zoot's sax, and they start coughing until it then redoubles and even triples in volume and fills up the whole screen.
I did like Zoot periodically peeking down the barrel of the bell of
the bell, yeah,
of the saxophone, being like, wait, is that is coming out? Wow. And then he keeps playing and more comes out and he does it again. And it does sound like as more and more smoke comes out, he gets worse and worse at the saxophone, mm-hmm, as well. I noticed that the second time I watched it. I was like, oh, this isn't as good as it should be. So I liked that detail,
yeah,
too.
The Muppet musicians, the real orchestra of Jack Parnell, do a fantastic job of having their sax playing deteriorate, mm-hmm, as this goes away. And matching up with what Dave is doing in terms of blowing in, or Dave does an excellent job of matching the sax players halting, starting, and stopping.
Yeah, it's really well done.
We then have, as I referred to earlier, an extended piece of writing by Jerry Jewell.
Oh, okay.
This is on the Muppet Wikia referred to as Fears of Zero, and it's an original Jerry Jewell poem that's written in the style of, in my opinion, Poe's The Raven.
Mm-hmm.
And he lists a series of things that he is afraid of. And sometimes they're serious and sometimes they're ironically clever. And at the end of each list, he then says, once they are counted and compelled, they can quickly be dispelled. And he does this by holding up a finger in front of his eyes, bulging his eyes up, and sort of making it an incantation, which he then moves his finger quickly to the side in order to perform the act of being dispelled. As he lists the different fears in each segment of the poem, monsters creepily come out of the bookcase or the edges of the frame around him, which then zoop away at the final line.
And then at the end of the sketch, a giant monster comes out and it's revealed that the monster has dispelled Zero.
Timmy Monster.
Timmy Monster, yes.
But this time with the fangs and not just the lips.
Yep. This reminded me, I should say, Zero's performance in this and in the Sam sketch from earlier. He reminds me of a goofy uncle who just likes to make silly faces and trying to make children laugh.
Mm.
And he strikes me as someone who's trying to make kids like him. But then in the recitation of this poem, which is definitely not in their wheelhouse, that he would lose them. And
he's the sort of uncle that accidentally makes little kids cry.
Yeah. And this sketch, to me, is trying to be in both worlds and doing neither successfully.
Hmm.
There they are. Confronted fears. Fears of hunger. Fears of pain.
Oh!
Fears of missing the last train. Fear of dentist always drilling.
Because when he's trying to be goofy, he's losing the power of the poem. And the entertaining bits weren't entertaining enough to make me last through the boringness of the poem. The two things don't gel for me.
I agree that it's trying to tread a thin edge of funny and creepy, and it has a very difficult task allotted to it in order to do that. I think the poem isn't quite funny, clever enough to make it fully successful or interesting. I think that nobody is as funny or clever as Poe, and that therefore that's a incredibly difficult metric to measure up to. The fact that Jewel does anything entertaining in this verse structure is impressive up against the yardstick of Poe, syphilitic madman.
And also, one of the things that happens in this sketch is towards the end, Zero reveals he's wearing a toupee.
Yes.
Which was shocking to me.
In the opening chapters, I did not read the entirety of the biography, but in the opening chapters, they do talk about that he goes bald. They address the, his weight gain over time and his baldness. And so when there is a line that says fears of baldness and that he then takes the wig off, again, the difference between watching it the first time and watching it the second time, the first time I was like, wait, has that been a wig the whole time? Or did they do a bald cap and a second wig in order to just do the special effect in order to make the joke work? But the second time round, I was pretty convinced that probably it may have been an open secret as to how bald he really was. I'm pretty sure in Funny Thing Happened, it's very clear how bald he really is. So there's his performance toupe, and they were able to negotiate, would you be okay with doing this in order to get the yucks?
So that was interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, his performance is good. It's just boring.
I think the staging and filming of the monsters is technically very well done.
Yeah.
And I think the twist at the end that he might be the fear of a giant monster is right down the middle in terms of Muppet humor.
Mm-hmm.
It's clever and obvious at the same time.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just, it's fine. It's not bad, but it is boring, but it's not funny, but it's not bad.
Fair enough. I didn't find it boring because I enjoyed the technical aspects of it.
Then we have our next backstage segment where Kermit is still lamenting about not being able to find another female wrestler. Just as he's describing what he needs, a heavyweight, aggressive, tough female with a killer's instinct, Piggy walks in.
He pitches Piggy on this, saying he needs an actress with tremendous strength and versatility, and she is buttered up and lists a couple of different parts that she thinks it might be. Joan of Arc, Naughty Marietta, and Lady Macbeth.
Kermit says it's more like a lady wrestler.
And then the end of this sketch is equally padded as the UK spot in that it's basically Piggy shrieking lady wrestler and Kermit yelling as they're being chased back and forth.
Lady wrestler!
What do you make of that, man?
10-1 on the pig.
In the foreground, we have Zoot and Floyd making bets as to whether or not the frog is going to survive. Mm-hmm. But it's just basically yelling and running back and forth.
Yep.
Pete.
Yeah.
I was talking earlier about I thought that the list of things that the act could have been before it was revealed to be Lady Wrestlers was pretty good writing.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that Jerry Jewell's poem had some pretty good lists in it.
Okay.
Here we have a list of three. Joan of Arc, Naughty Marietta, Lady Macbeth.
Yes.
If this was a joke, Naughty Marietta would be the third one because it's the most ludicrous of the three. If you were making something up in terms of strong female roles, surely that would be the third, which means that Naughty Marietta has to be a real thing.
Yeah. I just figured it was, and I wasn't cultured enough to know what it was. See, I liked Lady Macbeth being last because of more like Lady Wrestler.
Mm.
You needed that to be the third, so that way Kermit could say, could do the turn of lady to lady.
Okay, that works. Whereas I felt like that's the one that feels the most made up.
Yeah.
So therefore should have been third because it's the one that's going to get you to laugh.
But if it's made up and you don't recognize it as a thing or not, then it could potentially fail if you don't know what it is. Everyone knows Lady Macbeth.
Good point. I didn't know what it was, and it is a real thing.
Okay.
Naughty Marietta is a character from a 1910 operetta. That was made into a 1935 musical film from the director of The Thin Man.
Huh.
The Wikipedia entry on the operetta has the following sentence. It includes many well-known songs.
Okay.
Including, Ah, Sweet Majesty of Life.
I think they mean Ah, Sweet Caroline.
The thing is I've heard of Ah, Sweet Majesty of Life. And so I laughed very hard when I read those two sentences because, A, I didn't believe also that there would be many well-known songs in a 1910 operetta I'd never heard of.
Marietta.
That included a character named Naughty Marietta.
Operetta.
Pete?
Yes, Ben?
Could you get me a vanilla flake and stick it in some ice cream? Because I'd like a Viennetta.
Ooh. Only if you could make me a chocolate and vanilla cake and mix it all together for an operetta cake.
Well, I think one of us better get to this. And
Ben, yeah? Do you have any cheese? Because I sure could go for some cheddar.
You know, I'm not caught up on blank check because I haven't yet watched Benedetta.
Ben, with my cheddar, could I have some feta?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm going to have to repeat myself by saying, you better.
Did you know one of your brother's first cars was a Jetta?
I think I'm out.
Ben.
Yeah?
Don't forget, Mark Zuckerberg owns Meta.
Mm. I'm just surprised you didn't say, hey, Ben, don't forgetta that Mark Zuckerberg owns Meta. I know the title of the song, Ah, Sweet Mystery of Life, but I don't know how it goes. I don't know anything about it. It's just one of those things out there that I've heard of. And so now, well, I've been able to connect it to Naughty Marietta and her 1910 operetta.
Marietta.
And I just love the fact that this thing that I don't know that I've heard of is now connected to this other thing that I don't know. It's a great chain of ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the perfect level of not knowing something.
Right. And now I've shared it with all of you.
Very good. Yeah, this will probably get cut. It's one of those things that I love knowing things about movies and knowing things about movies I've never seen and people being wildly shocked when I recite something about some fact about a movie. And I'm like, oh, yeah, I love that movie. And I go, oh, yeah, I've never seen that. And they're like, wait, and then how do you know this specific piece of trivia about it? I'm like, I just know things. So it's perfect for that.
Yeah. Just feel the nice warmth of that fact like you're wearing a cozy sweater.
You just guaranteed it staying in the episode. Ben, are you excited for May?
Always.
Because that's the next time you're going to get to see your friend Dominic Toretta in Fast 10.
I can't believe you feminized Dominic Toretto in that way. He's going to punch you in the head.
No, he won't. I'm family.
After the chase back and forth and the yelling, we have a drum solo where Animal plays the drum so hard they catch fire.
Yep, that's it.
It was a truly impressive jet of fire. I was at least a little impressed with the bravery of the puppeteering. And so therefore, wasn't actually funny, but still impressive that they were like, yeah, this is how far we're willing to go in order to do this punchline.
The drum solo also has very interesting rhythm to it. I enjoyed the drum solo. But yeah, there's nothing to it other than he plays the drum solo and they catch fire. Done.
It's basically a wipe joke.
Yep.
But with extra dangerous special effects. Pete?
Yes, Ben?
Does a drum going up in flames count as an explosion?
No, because it doesn't explode. It catches fire.
There wasn't a explosive jet of fire?
No, it's from the friction of him playing the drum so hard that it catches fire.
Okay. Even though it felt like a pillar of flame that was going up with explosive force because it didn't happen because of an explosion.
Correct. I also don't count how many times Animal hits the drums.
Roger that.
Scooter then introduces a cultural demonstration of female grace and dexterity, which is then revealed to be wrestling.
Straight from the Bally High Bowl-rama, we have Granny Gouger versus Miss Mask.
The mysterious Miss Mask.
The mysterious Miss Mask. The ring is revealed. It's probably the same ring where Gonzo wrestled a brick.
Yep.
And we have Kermit in a wig and a cape and a bathing suit and a mask. I'm not sure if we're supposed to really get the idea that because they couldn't find a second female wrestler, Kermit is standing in for this.
I think he's trying to get away with it, because if he doesn't do lady wrestling, he doesn't get the money.
Yeah.
So he needs to put wrestling on, otherwise there's no paycheck.
To me, there's a link missing there. Someone needs to comment on it, whether it's the guys in the box or Granny saying, not used to fighting men, something to give us a little bit, because otherwise I don't think it lands.
I do because of the name The Mysterious Miss Mask.
Okay.
It may not be clear whether or not people know that he's not him, except later when he ends up in the box, but he's trying to pull one over on JP.
And you feel like that's good enough as he is.
Because if it's commented on, then he didn't succeed in it and he won't get the money.
Okay.
But in an episode, as we've discussed, full of, that didn't really work. I get why that doesn't really work.
We then have, speaking of things that do work, a series of pretty well-executed, interesting camera setups in terms of the wrestling. There are some pretty unusual positions of the camera next to the Muppets in order to pull off some effects of people being held and grabbed and thrown. And we get our next major arm movement here, which is at the conclusion of a couple of grapples, Granny throws Kermit up into the box. And I thought that that move of her having her hands on Kermit and then him being launched out of shot was the last really good hand interaction with a Muppet that's not a hand puppet.
So he ends up in the box and Statler says, "You better give up, Frog."
And the Frog says, "What? And leave show business?"
Good joke.
Then we cut back to ground where Piggy angrily steps into the ring saying, "What did you do to my frog? I'll show you," and hi-yah's Granny. And she goes down pretty hard and she gets knocked back with the karate chop.
There are three hits here.
Mm.
She hits Kermit twice by jumping on his arm or torso. We don't really see. Yeah. After she's tied his arm up into knots in front of him, she then kind of jumps on him twice.
And then Piggy takes out her in one.
Yes. So that would be hits 4, 5, and 6.
And then there's a pretty rapid fade to black on Piggy and the knocked down Granny, which comes back up to Kermit in front of the curtain wearing a cast and a series of different bandages and a sling, saying, "Well, that's about it. Some of us have taken great pains to bring you this show. But first, we'd like to thank our guest." And they bring out, as you said, Zero Mostel, who they inform us has joined the ranks of the Muppet Monsters.
And yeah, he comes out with two monsters making another face that a kid would love.
But that Sam hates.
Yeah.
And he interrupts saying, "Stop that! Stop that!"
And Zero just does. There's just no mention of why he should or protestation from him. Sam says, "Stop it." Zero stops it. And then Kermit goes, "We'll see you next time on the Muppet Show." And that's when Zero again says, "Must there be a next time?" And then as the credits roll, Zero and Sam look at each other, and then Zero puts all of Sam's beak in his mouth.
It's interesting that you phrase it in that passive way. I would just use the verb to bite. I would say that Zero chomps down hard on Sam's beak.
But he doesn't close his jaw. He just puts his mouth over the beak. It never closes. Maybe it cuts away before it closes. But there's a good moment of time, it appeared to me, where he's just like, "Yep, this is in my mouth now."
I'm going to blame timing as him in not knowing when the cut is, because I feel like it's not a, how do I phrase this? It's not like he places himself in a position where he can rest his mouth on the beak.
Yeah.
He goes for Sam face first. Mm-hmm. Like, it's an attack.
Now that you mention that.
It's a lunge.
Yeah. I don't know if it was planned or not. And I wonder if he did it improvisationally, and then once he had his mouth on it, went, "Oh, I shouldn't bite on this."
Or if it wasn't improvisational, they were like, "You shouldn't bite on this.
Yeah, please don't bite on this. That's where my hand is."
He gets the action of the lunge with a lot of force, but then has to stop so as to not damage the puppet.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's the thing, is that you talk about him stopping wordlessly as if he just accepts the situation. I think
he's plotting.
He's waiting, and that once Kermit's done, he's then going for the thing that shut down his monstrousness.
Okay, that makes more sense to me. That definitely makes it a little bit better and less weird.
And it also therefore has an eerie echo of, "There may not be a show after this, Kermit, because I'm going to eat your American bird." Yeah. And who knows who else.
45 years, I'll punch anything up. It would have been interesting if he said that line of, "Must there be a next time," and then dispelled the entire cast.
Huh. That is interesting.
I really like that as an ending instead.
Yeah. We'll get other weird endings in front of the curtain that have a certain kind of existential dread to them, where people have been infected or transformed and altered. And as a kid, I would watch them and be like, "Wait, is this still going to be this way next week?"
Yeah, it's the Simpsons thing.
Uh-huh, where I'm just sort of left there feeling uneasy and uncomfortable with the fact that they didn't fix everything before they went to credits. And therefore, I'm okay with the idea that Zero didn't banish all the Muppets to the Phantom Zone right before.
If they had done that already and things like that had happened, it would have been a very good ending. But to do it episode 2 of season 2 might be a little too early.
I just think more along the lines of, it creates a certain tone.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that tone is more effective on little people than it is on somebody my age. But in general, it is still therefore a sense of potential anti-climax of, "We're ending things on the Muppet Show. My voice goes up." And then the audience goes, "Rah!" And the music goes, "Wah!" To then have it be, and then
da-da-da-da-da-da. But then you could have done the, you could have reused the Jess Rolf on the piano one too. They could have raptured all of the cast and crew, or leftovers, and only 2% of the world was left. Or no, it's 2% are gone.
I agree. You could have done something weird and awkward, therefore, with the empty orchestra pit and the credits. But I think that would have, much like the finale of Sledgehammer, done that same sense of like, wait, how real is this? That's creating a tone. Mm-hmm. That's doing a thing. And I'm glad that they did it with Rolf on the solo piano. I'm also glad that the Muppet Show doesn't dabble in those waters too often.
Yeah.
Great idea.
45 years, punch anything up. Speaking of things that don't need punching up, though, we then have the last Statler and Waldorf television bit.
So what do you think of television, Statler says to Waldorf.
And Waldorf grabs the TV, starts shaking from getting shocked.
And Statler says, it's shocking, isn't it?
And then does a stupid laugh. And then Waldorf reaches out and grabs him.
And conducts the electricity through himself into Statler so that they're both making creepy electrocuted face.
Yep. It's good.
Couldn't have done that if they'd all been dispelled, Pete.
No, it's true. But I only talked about dispelling the cast and crew. I didn't mention any. They're not getting paid by J.P. Gross for their act in this show.
But who knows? Who knows how powerful that fickle finger of Zero Mostel is.
It's true. Only Jerry Jewell.
You can know for sure. Well, you've talked about hits and kisses and
explosions.
So let's do the summary of what's there and let's get into the rankings.
There were 6 hits, 1 explosion, 4 human Muppet kisses. There was 8.96 minutes of music out of 26.55 minutes of show, which is a 33.75% music rate.
Huh. When you just said 8, I thought it was going to be our lowest number, but 33 is not. Again, that's in our bottom third, but it's still not a record breaker.
It is...
second from the bottom?
Yes. It is 0.09 minutes longer than the Steve Martin episode. Or more music than the Steve Martin episode, because their episode lengths are not the same. But yeah, that was 33.57%. This is 33.75%. So very close. I would also like to point out that What Do the Simple Folk Do? Was 51% of the music in the entire episode. Both What Do the Simple Folk Do and the Fear poem segment
are over 3 minutes?
Are very long. The What Do the Simple Folk Do might be our longest section yet, at over 4.5 minutes long.
Yeah, I would be very surprised if it wasn't.
4.5 minutes is forever in The Muppet Show, and in this case, it felt like it. As far as rankings go, we had some more movement. People got shifted.
You put him someplace somebody previously was.
Yes. I put him where Don Knotts was, which shifted Steve Martin up. Steve is now 21, Don Knotts is 22, and Zero Mostel is 23.
I'm not surprised. I wouldn't have even been surprised if you had not given yourself the safety of 24 and just said, actually, I can't imagine an episode being worse than this.
Yeah, I didn't dislike him, but I also didn't like him. Like,
he's not your flavor.
No, but his performances are really good.
Yeah.
I didn't like the song, I didn't like the poem, but he does a really good job at both of them.
Yeah.
You said it perfectly. He's not my flavor. Not my tempo. I couldn't put him above Steve Martin, because even though I have my qualms with Steve, I would watch those bits, because they're Steve Martin's bits, every time over his. Mm. And then, to be honest, couldn't remember Don Knotts all that well, even though it was 2 weeks ago. But I remembered vaguely enjoying what he did, so I just put Zero below him. My instinct was to put him between the two of them, but I was like, no, I don't think I can do that. So yeah, he's 23rd. Sorry, Zero. Rest in power.
I don't have any problem with that ranking. I actually think it's a very high caliber of effort, and I would like to rate it higher.
Yes, agreed.
If I found it to be successfully entertaining.
Agreed. I felt bad putting him that low because he is doing a lot of work.
I would just say that I think there's a chance that if you knew more about Zero Mostel's work, you would also be saying he's just doing his shtick with the Muppets.
Fair.
I don't know if that's accurate. I've seen Forum, but not for many years. I know he can do other things. I had a lot of praise for his work on The Hot Rock when Anna and I did that for the podcast. I think he's very good in that. I think he has range. But I think he also does shtick. And I think he's doing shtick here. Mm-hmm. Which is the other reason why I'm actually backing up your rating. In that I think if you knew more of his work, you would also come to the conclusion
that he's
not doing enough different.
Gotcha. Well then, I feel doubly justified.
Well, take that feeling of justification and start off our five favorite moments with what you want to point out that we should notice to take away from this episode that is worth remembering.
For my first moment, I would like to go back to the UK spot that you didn't realize was a UK spot. And we briefly talked about this, but when Kermit is swallowing the phrase lady wrestlers over and over and over again, it's such a good performance by Jim.
It's just, we got some lady wrestlers. Stand by for the pantomime number.
Lady what?
Lady wrestlers.
And also, I always love when people are ashamed. You know, this is one of my things. When people are ashamed of something but are forced to admit it. Classic Pete favorite comedy bit. So, yeah, him just saying, lady wrestlers, is so good. And then in that same section, when Sam is pacing back and forth, approving of the things that he's saying beforehand, it seems like his wings are behind his back and he's just striding and going, The two of those things together are so good. Lady wrestlers.
I sort of said that my runner on the episode was the puppeteering of throwing things. Mm-hmm. And if I were you, I would probably combine those into one moment.
I'm a filthy cheater.
However, I'm just going to talk about the third one where Granny throws him into the box. Mm-hmm. It's not the throw that made me laugh. It's the landing.
Oh, okay.
Because I laughed like crazy when Kermit lands in the box and Statler and Waldorf don't even look up from the television. They are watching TV. They are glued to the boob tube, not just because it's television, because they are steadfastly not watching the Muppet Show. I'm even a little surprised that Statler acknowledged Kermit at all to say, give it up, kid.
Yeah, that means he was paying attention enough to know that he lost.
Yeah. There's a chance that based on the earlier segment of them saying they're watching two old guys watching television, that they're watching the Muppet Show on television at this point. And so what they saw was what the camera was showing us. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point, speaking of your pal Mark Zuckerberg, that if they stuck to the episode from there, that would explain why he knew that the frog ended up in the box. Mm-hmm. Because while he wasn't watching the live thing, he was watching the TV, which was showing that the frog was losing the match.
Yep.
It's good.
Either way, it's the fact that they were sticking the bit that I wanted to applaud.
This isn't my moment, but it's part of your moment, so I'm going to say something.
Yeah.
I also really liked Granny going, alley-oop, before throwing Kermit.
Well, now that you've gotten that out of your system, why don't you give us your third or second moment, depending on how you count them.
It is our third, my second moment. And we talked about Beaker not being Beaker, but I don't care because I still love Beaker. This being his first introduction, you're right. It's not as good if this was the first time we'd ever seen him. But because we know Beaker and the way he peeks around the corner at the introduction and his mouth is just open and he's shaking nervously, struck a very big chord with this anxiety-ridden boy. I know exactly the feeling that he's feeling right now, and I just love Beaker's agape mouth of like, oh no, oh boy.
Beaker, come on in here and let's show the Muppet Lab's brand new magnetic carrots. Come on, Beaker, just pick up the lid there. It's all right. Isn't that snazzy?
Whereas I would say, I like that from the get-go, Beaker is committed to the fact that he hates this. It's yeah. not just the anxiety. This is his first production appearance. And when Bunsen says, isn't that snazzy? Beaker is shaking his head no. Like, he's already noping out yep. of the entire premise of his participation in the show. He's barely showed up and he's like, I hate this. I don't want to be here on every level.
Yes and is the rule of comedy, but no but is so funny.
It is my favorite bit of action. Yes. A no but is what makes me happier than almost any other kind of joke. Be good if I had a no but to round out my moments with, but I don't think I do. Instead, I'm going to point out the piece of writing that I thought was the funniest in the episode, which is that when Statler and Waldorf are talking about the film that they're watching instead of The Muppet Show, the writers, whichever particular cocktail of the credited writers came up with this, decide to do a pastiche of, I'm assuming, what they think is the worst of the worst of entertainment. And they squash together Elvis movies and monster movies to come up with
Beach Blanket Frankenstein. Awful. Terrible film.
And that's brilliant. It's my new favorite band name. It's a great combination of the kind of movie that MST3K would make fun of. In fact, I'm pretty sure there is a teens get killed by a marauding alien yep. MST3K episode. So whether it's a pastiche or an actual summation of the kinds of crappy movies that the Muppeteers probably had the opportunity to sit through and that MST3K made fun of later, regardless of its source, I laughed like a drain and I wanted to point it out.
For my third moment, our final moment, I want to talk about Chopin!
Chopin! Chopin!
It is traditional for us to end our five favorite moments with highlighting a vociferous Frank moment, so I'm going to co-sign on this as a choice.
I mentioned how much I liked Polonaise in A-flat. You mentioned Animal shouting Chopin over and over again. Because it's so good.
It's funny.
And I already barely know who Chopin is.
Because you're more of a fan of Au Bon Pain than Chopin.
I believe you mean Au Bon Pain. So now I will never not think, whenever someone says Chopin, of Animal shouting Chopin. And also,
yeah.
The internet must not like this episode because they want this episode to show them feet, not pants.
Every time you're going to walk into kitchens and things and say, show me the pants.
Internet just wants feet. And Jerry Maguire just wants the money.
That's right. Whereas the fact that the pan in Au Bon Pain.
Yes, is bread.
Means that I feel like you should be trying to do a House of Pan, House of Pain, House of Bread pun to finish this up.
I'm not gonna. I'm just gonna assume that you listening back to this, you just cut at whatever you thought the best last joke was. And I'm hoping that it's before it turns into the just meandering, trying to find the joke that leads out of the episode.
Oh yeah, definitely.
This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design such as this, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Amlin. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast to Salmon Friends.
You can find us at farstperspective.com and follow us on Twitter at @FarstMainBasis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the lasting power of comedic phenomena.
All excerpts in this podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, dog acts, jugglers, spoon players, or Irish tenors, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Chopa!
And we'll see you after the mid-season break when we discuss Season 2, Production Episode 13, guest starring Rudolf Nureyev. Yay!